The following presents a program from the Davisville Archives. It was recorded in January 2013.
Coming up today on Davisville, the resolution of a local murder case 32 years later with author Joel Davis. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're tuning in. This is Davisville on KDRT Radio in Davis, California. I'm Bill Buchanan, I'm the host, and thank you for listening. Today's guest is Joel Davis. Joel Davis is a journalist, he's a hometown Davis writer, and his book, Justice Waits, the UC Davis Sweetheart Murders, played a key role in solving the 1980 Davis murder of John Riggins and Sabrina Gonzalez. In December 2012, 32 years to the month after the slayings, a Sacramento Superior Court convicted Richard Hirschfield of first-degree murder for killing Gonzalez and Riggins. They were both 18, and he kidnapped them, basically, shortly after they had finished volunteering for an evening performance of the annual children's show, The Nutcracker. I've invited Joel on Davisville today to talk about the resolution of the case, which is, in a sense, the resolution of his book as well. Let me say a little bit more about him before we start. Joel is 50. He formerly worked at the Davis Enterprise. He's taught journalism at American River College and Sacramento State University and worked for the newspaper trade publication Editor and Publisher. His other work includes what I think was a standout first-person essay that he wrote for the News and Review, Sacramento News and Review, back in 2004. It's called The Heart of the Gray Matter, in which he wrote about the trauma of brain surgery he had and his struggle to overcome Parkinson's, with which he has lived since 2001. As listeners might notice in this interview, the effect of the disease may show up when he talks. So, Joel, thanks for coming by Davisville.
Happy to be here.
Could you start by briefly recapping the case, who John Riggins and Sabrina Gonzalez were and what happened?
John Riggins is kind of the archetypical hometown hero, boy wonder sort of person who I admired from afar. I went to high school and junior high with him. He was hard to miss because he was a standout athlete. He had very distinct red hair, and I kind of knew him by osmosis in the sense that he knew and was good friends with athletes that I played basketball with. So that's how I just knew him in general. And then Sabrina, I didn't really know at all because she's not from this area, but they got together as freshmen at UC Davis and became each other's first boyfriend and girlfriend. And I really didn't know anything about her until I started doing the research on the book, but they were kind of the all-American couple, really.
And the crime was that on that night in December of 1980, they were kidnapped and then killed.
Correct. And this was my senior year in high school, so it really stands out. In fact, it happened around my 18th birthday, and I really don't remember my 18th birthday because this was such a traumatic thing to happen to Davis, which at that time was more of a college town than the university city it's become.
Yeah. Hirschfield was sentenced to death, and we'll get into the trial a little bit, but I'm curious. The jury suggested death for him. I don't know if he's been formally sentenced yet, but
he will be in January, and all signs point to the fact that the judge will comply with the jury's edict.
Does that sound right to you, the verdict and the sentence?
Well, personally, I have issues with the death penalty in general, and I have issues with it in California because basically it doesn't work. But I've always said I don't walk in the family's shoes, and they seem to be happy with it. And I was happy to see them happy after all these years. I mean, it didn't take long for the jury to decide that part of the case. And what it comes down to is the mathematical probability of him dying from the death penalty is practically nil because he's 63 years old. And we all know that appeals take forever with the death penalty in California. So what it comes down to, and the families, they kind of rationaled this out in front of me when we were having lunch and stuff, that the accommodations on death row for a death row prisoner are a lot more Spartan than they are if he's in the general population with a life without parole sentence. So I think they're just happy that he's going to be watched all the time and he has a sentence hanging over him where he's not going to be able to really get out. And I don't think it's a death penalty issue to them so much as just he's going to have it a little harder.
One of the things that I think is, I mean, obviously it was the police work that provided the evidence that, that convicted him. But I don't think it's overstating it to say that the book that you wrote, Justice Waits, which was first published in
2005, the first edition.
2005, so nearly 8 years ago now. That kept the case, I think, front and center. It kept a larger group of people engaged in the case and interested in the case, and I think helped spur the resolution of it.
Yeah, I won't deny that. I think where I got kind of, if you want to say lucky, I don't know if that's the right word for this case, but I came along when nobody was really looking at it.
Yeah.
And I think timing was everything as far as being an author and having this sort of publicity from it, because when I came along, it was around 2000. I'd always wanted to write a book, and this was the one issue that they say write about what you're curious about because you're going to get tired of it, and sure enough, you do. But I had always been curious about this because this was unresolved. And then when I started digging around, it became very apparent to me that it was kind of a mess. And yet here there were these two stellar kids from two stellar families. They had had this other group that was prosecuted by Woodland called the Hunt Group, and that turned out to have but sort of died on the vine. And
you know, that was another lead in this case earlier on.
Yeah, it was a big lead. And when I was – the whole point of the exercise was kind of to see if they were the ones who did it. And to be honest with you, at first I was leaning towards the fact that they did it. It's a pretty sexy theory when you first look at it. But you hold it up to the light, and if you especially hold it up to the light now with the DNA evidence and the technologies that they have – it just doesn't wash. And whereas here they had DNA with Hirschfield.
Yeah.
I talked to the foreman of the jury, and he said it was simple. And it's kind of sad that it took this long to get to this point to make this deduction, because it was a simple deduction that the jury made, was the DNA on the blanket that was found in the van and the fact that the guy's brother who was involved killed himself when he was confronted with it. That sealed it for the jury. And yet the trial took 3 months and the case took 32 years.
So. You know, and we won't have time to go into all the details of the case here. The book that you wrote obviously has the case to a certain point, and then the trial was well covered in the local press this fall by the Davis Enterprise, among others.
Right.
You know, you talk about how you took the book up in 20 years after. And in fact, you say in the preface that you left Davis because you moved out of town after you. But the case never left you.
Yeah.
What held on to you? Why after 20 years?
It was just sort of – I guess everybody has an event in their life that has a seismic impact on them. I've talked to people since then, authors and so forth, who said, yeah, there's this one murder in my town. I'd love to solve it, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't take this on so much to solve it. In fact, if I knew I'd be talking about it 12 years later, I'm not sure I would have done it. But just curiosity, just plain old journalistic curiosity, because I knew him. There was no motive for it. That was a big issue too. Why was this done? You know, because with the Hunt Group, they didn't have a motive beyond the fact that it was this sort of far-fetched copycat theory with the Gallego Group, and I won't get into that. But once the DNA became front and center, it became obvious that the sexual assault of Sabrina Gonzalez was the motive.
Yeah.
And the suspect, Hirschfield, he had a long history of sexual crimes, and they had victims of his testifying at the hearings and the trial and everything else, and it became very obvious what it was once they got the DNA match.
Isn't it unusual for a murder that's 32 years old to be solved like this? I mean, because evidence decays and memories blur and witnesses die and so on.
I think you just now gave away the defense's prevent defense right there. They did not want to go to trial. And
they were trying to play out the clock.
Yeah, it was kind of exactly. And I asked a defense attorney friend of mine who actually knew John Reagan, so he had no biases of it. And he gave me a great quote. He said, the best thing next to an acquittal is a continuance. And sure enough, at this trial, had you not had the DNA, there would have been a lot of problems, because there were a lot of people coming in walkers and wheelchairs with bad memories. And they were probably perfectly fine public servants at the time, but they didn't look too good at the stand now.
Sure, because the idea of reasonable doubt.
Right.
Like a third of a century later, you're thinking maybe you're not remembering it.
You go long enough and you're not going to have anybody. And I think that was the defense's modus operandi all along, because when you get down to it, the prosecutor had a full house and the defense had a pair of twos at best to work with. I mean, the DNA nowadays is really strong in juries' minds. And the fact that you had a guy's brother who was living a mile from where this happened kill himself when he's confronted with it, and, you know, those two issues just kept standing out to the jury no matter what the defense threw at him.
So, but it is pretty unusual.
Though, oh, yeah.
For a third
yeah.
of us. I mean, I guess DNA now may change that, because DNA endures where memories and such do
right.
not.
Right. I see more and more of this now. At the time, it was fairly new. In fact, the thing that I did to kind of turn the corner on the case is I just flagged it to a new sex crimes unit that I'd read about in the Sacramento Bee that was starting to do DNA testing. And I just told him, I said, hey, have you looked at this Davis case? It's a prime candidate for it. And I kind of got lots of different answers on it. But about 2 months after I flagged them, they did get a hit on this. And it was like 1 in 240 trillion match. And this is kind of gross, but what they found on the blanket was semen. And semen apparently is like one of the strongest lasting DNA samples you can get. I don't know why that is, but it is entirely possible. And we heard this over and over again at the trial, for it to last on a substance for that long.
Did you go to the trial?
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like you went to it fairly often.
Pretty much as I could stand. Because to be honest with you, 95% of what I heard was stuff I'd already written about, only it was done in a very tediously lawyerly
in the court way, because they're establishing evidence.
They took the most circuitous routes to, I'm kind of the impatient Titan Bright writing type journalist. And so what I would take a half hour to put in a paragraph would take 5 days. And I understand the need for that, but it was kind of hard for me. It was kind of like a long rerun of Gilligan's Island, you know?
Yeah.
With all the outtakes included, so It was tough, but I wanted to be there for the families and for any follow-up work I do with it. And the families were absolutely great. They're very gracious through the whole thing.
The families have been complimentary to you.
Yeah, and they became almost like second families to me. I was amazed at just how well how composed they were. In fact, my favorite part of the trial was the fact that the Riggins's, John's parents, they came down for this, and they decided, because they didn't attend much of the first fiasco, they were going to keep a sharp eye on this, and they actually rented a loft right by the courthouse. And after a while, the best part of it for me every day was that all the people who were their supporters would do a potluck lunch every day to kind of get away from what they just saw in court, and that was just fantastic.
I want to note that Richard Riggins, John Riggins' father, in September, as Hirschfield's trial began, thanked you by name for your work on this.
Yeah,
they've
been great.
That.
They've been great. They kind of hung with me through it all. I mean, I had a period with my Parkinson's that wasn't going so well, and yet they stuck with me. And you know, that has been a friendship that came out of this that I'll always cherish. You know, and they're just fantastic people. So are the Gonzalves, but I just don't know them as well because they're not as attached to Davis, but they're great as well.
So now this is a case when you started this. I expect you were more of a traditional journalist, kind of objective.
Yeah.
And clearly by the end of it, I mean, everything I'm hearing from you believes that the right person was convicted. And
yeah. I kind of was able to take the license of an author and throw out the journalism sort of objectivity that maybe someone from the Bee or the Enterprise would have. For instance, I was able to go over to the lunches, whereas the Bee and the Enterprise would always decline citing ethics. But when, you know, I don't know if it's advocacy journalism, but over time, because I became part of the story, I didn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
The one thing I've heard more, maybe people are just shining me on, but I've heard a lot of people say, well, I wanted more of you in the book and your experiences. And in the follow-up that I'm planning on doing, there'll be more of that, just because I tried to keep myself as out of it as much as possible. As you know, being a former journalist or a journalist now, you don't put me in as much as you do they. And
the danger is that you know, we can put something in that is self-interesting but isn't really all that interesting to the
right
audience.
And I say it in the foreword, you're not here to read about me unless you're my mom.
And so now you're updating your book?
Yeah. I'm dabbling, just because I'm also interested in the technology. I just ordered 500 copies of the hardcover because that was running out. It always runs out at the most inopportune times. So I got a lot of those left to sell, and most of those sell on Amazon. I've kept a website going since this happened. It's called justicewaste.com. But the way I'm probably going to update it, just for conveniences and technology purposes, is through an ebook.
Okay.
And
will it be a new edition of the book? Or?
Yeah, I'll fix some typos and misnomers of the hardcover. The nice thing about ebooks, at least to me, I haven't done one yet, and that's part of the appeal, is going through the process of doing one. The nice thing about ebooks is if you screw up, you can get in there and fix it. Whereas a printed book, the old saying that coroners bury their mistakes and journalists print theirs is very apparent in a hardcover book. I mean, to pull those back and make fixes is really expensive. Whereas an ebook, it just makes sense for this. Because I know a lot of people who have the hardcover probably wouldn't buy another hardcover, but they might pay a little less for an ebook and just for the epilogue, because that's all it's going to really be, is an epilogue, albeit a long one.
Once you've done that, do you think the story will feel finished to you?
It already kind of does.
There's the sentencing and the appeals, and there could be a surprise there, I suppose.
Yeah. But. I mean, he's a wily suspect. Nobody's ever accused him of being stupid. He's been accused of a lot of other things, and I'm sure he'll throw everything he has into the appeals. But there was a sense of finality to the day that we all walked out that last time. Now we're going to have to all get together with the formal sentencing, where he's going to have his say, and that's going to be God knows what. But it's funny. I was not that emotional about it. And then the last day we were in court when he got the death penalty, and this was more to do with the resolution of things, I finally cried, and I think that got it out of me. And I'll give Lauren Keene some credit, the Enterprise, because she quoted me as saying, "How do you feel?" And it wasn't so much happiness as relief.
Yeah.
Because you worked that long on something, there's a point you kind of wish it would stop. And I just said I was relieved, and then I said I was happy to see the family smiling again, because they've been through so much in this. And they had some smiles on their faces for the first time in a long time. So,
I should mention Lauren Keene was the writer for the Davis Enterprise who covered the trial.
Yeah, she did an excellent job. The prosecution, although we'll never be sending each other Christmas cards, they did an excellent job staying focused. The guy at the B, Andy Ferrillo, did an excellent job. I was kind of like journalist emeritus sitting back and watching it all, because I'm doing consulting work for the TV show CBS 48 Hours Mystery, and I'll give that a plug because they're going to do a whole new hour of the show on the case. I think it's going to air in March.
And they did one originally some years ago when your book came out.
Yeah, and that I didn't realize how that much that sold books until they pulled it off the air for the case. But
well, and I suppose it's worth noting in passing that this is one of those moments where Davis, for absolutely the wrong reasons in this case, but Davis became a national story.
Yeah, as I put in a book, to me it was sort of the over-under of when Davis went from a college town to a university city. I mean, a lot of people have said that too, but then you talk to people who moved here in the last 30 years and never heard of it, and so.
Well, and I wonder.
It's a kind of an I guess you had to be there type thing, but it was.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you grew up in Davis, and it's been a long time, and Davis is still a relatively low-crime town. I mean, there's not, there have been a run of muggings lately that the Enterprise has mentioned,
right.
but nothing like this.
Right.
And I don't know that people who weren't here then feel the impact of the crime the same way that people did at the time, because it doesn't feel like something that could happen in Davis even now.
If it was to happen, say, next week, God forbid, I think the town would feel that sort of wave of terror that we felt here. I mean, parents, it was interesting because at the court hearings, it wasn't so much the contemporaries of John and Sabrina I saw, because they all had jobs and kids. It was hard for them to get to court. I saw an awful lot of parents, and they told me the same thing. They said this just was mind-blowing at the time as a parent, because if it could happen to these two athletic, strong, aware kids with no apparent bad things in their background, it could happen to anybody. I remember taking the dog on walks behind my house, and that just felt creepy, I mean, I'm sure as any of us got to enjoy our senior year with what had happened, but I think parents kind of took the attack that if you could keep life as normal as you could for your kids, that would be a good thing. And I know the Riggins went out of their way to do that for their surviving two kids.
How did Hirschfield look to you in court?
It's funny because I was expecting more of a circus act from him because he's kind of notorious for, you know, firing attorneys and doing that. He seemed very kind of laconic and I won't say out of it, but he just, I mean, I was almost impressed by his ability just to sit still given the tedium of the proceedings. The one thing he did that I thought was a little bit of a trick of some sorts is anytime there was damning information said about him, which was about every 5 minutes in this case, he would whisper in his attorney's ear. And I think it almost became like a nervous habit for him to do that, almost as if to show the jury, look, I didn't do it, and here's why I'm whispering in my attorney's ear. It was kind of like a windshield wiper doing that when there was bad, damning information against him.
He'd always, so I can picture him, what you're saying, leaning over.
Yeah, he would whisper in his ear almost as if to deflect the damning information against him.
And it didn't work, though, right? Because the jury convicted him in a matter of hours.
Yeah. And it was like a filibuster on the defense team to try and get this thing not resolved. But he behaved himself, but he did do that one little trick where he would always whisper in the attorney's ear, like, this is not true. You know, look at me, jury. I'm debating it. And the jury wasn't buying any of it. He did give the jury a bit of a stank eye when they were all pulled on whether or not he should be put to death. I that's the one thing I noticed. He was, like, staring holes in him. But the foreman was a tough guy, and he was staring holes right back. That was sort of a psychological drama that played out throughout the case.
We mentioned at the outset that you had Parkinson's and
still do.
And when you were diagnosed after you started working on the book, and so you completed the book despite that.
Yeah, it was probably the toughest thing I had to deal with in getting the book done. But a lot of it had to do with promises, and I was so far into it by the time that the PD was Parkinson's was diagnosed that I couldn't not finish it. I'm somebody who I'm kind of proud of the fact that I've never really missed deadlines. Yeah. I mean, I've turned in some sloppy copy, but I never missed deadlines, and that sort of stuck with me. And I had the families really urging me to finish it, and so I did finish it. And in some ways, there was a sort of double benefit in the sense that that story you mentioned from the News and Review about my surgery, mm-hmm. that got a lot of notice. It won awards. That kind of put me on the map as a writer. So when the book came out, I could point to the Parkinson's story as being legitimate journalism. And so they kind of helped each other.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I want to quote just the opening to the News and Review article. It's still online. People can find it. It's not behind a firewall or anything.
No.
And
it comes complete with gross pictures, too.
Yeah. But and so now I'm quoting from, this is the very start of your article. It says, despite the advance directives, despite the dire warnings, despite the night before visit by a clergyman, and despite the ashen look on my wife's face right before they wheeled me into the operating room, the gravity of brain surgery to alleviate my aggressive Parkinson's symptoms didn't really hit home until Dr. Conrad Pappas started sawing into my skull.
Yeah.
And it goes on from there.
There was no hyperbole to that. You have to be awake while the drill goes in. And,
right, because they want to observe the reaction.
Right, and the way I got through it, believe it or not, is I just made out baseball lineups. I know some people prayed, but that would have been a little Hippocratic to me. So I just made out baseball lineups while I did it. And it was actually not too bad because by the time they do that, you're pretty well drugged up. The head cage they put on you was a different story. That was kind of medieval, but
yeah, that's one of the article, too. The idea is to keep your head very, very still.
Yeah, you don't want to move while they're drilling your head.
How are you doing these days?
I'm doing pretty well. I mean, you know, it's more evident. It's a progressive disease, but it's also one where they can throw a lot of stuff at it, a lot of pills, a lot of the procedures, and you got to keep moving with it. Exercise. The worst thing you can do is just sit home and have a pity party, and I kind of went through that stage, and everybody kind of has to. I don't know the formal name of the five stages of grief or whatever.
Yeah.
When I was in denial, it would have been great to have the denial part and the still feeling pretty good part at the same time. I would have gone on cruises and trips, but that was kind of the hardest part was the acceptance. Once you're over the acceptance, at least for me, it was fine. So, I'm as happy as I've ever been, you know.
What's next for you?
Parkinson's takes a lot of my day, just managing it, but I do a lot of volunteering, which I never would have done had I not been thrown into a situation that makes you more compassionate. So I do a lot of neighborhood stuff. I'm doing some editing, doing some writing, lots of bowling because that helps me. Basically doing whatever I want, and that's a nice thing to have. I mean, it's one of the few perks of having a chronic degenerative disease is you can kind of chart your own course, and hopefully I'm doing things for the better.
All right. We've been talking with Joel Davis, the local journalist. You live in Sacramento these days?
Yeah.
Who wrote the book Justice Waits, the UC Davis Sweetheart Murders, several years ago, and he's got updated online. And again, the website is...
JusticeWaits.com.
JusticeWaits.com.
You can buy it there or you can get it on Amazon. There's...
So when do you think you'll have the update posted?
Probably as soon as we're done with the... I kind of learned from doing the moving target thing with the book, so probably when it's finally resolved through the courts with the formal sentencing in February.
Okay.
I'll start it then, you know, and it shouldn't take too long.
So, Joel, thanks for coming by Davisville.
Thanks for having.
This is Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. We're going to end with a song by Gene Parsons. It's from a live record he did called I Hope They Let Us In, and the song is Sweet Desert Childhood. This is KDRT. Thanks for listening.
This is a story about where I was raised. It was up the desert road, 14 miles up in the canyon, I was born. Where the rocks were piled up high, and when the sun went down, they looked like big old monsters. You could yell out your whole name and your echo would come back crystal clear. And the silence was so deafening, you could hear it like thunder in your ears. I still taste the sweet cool water as it bubbled out to quench the burning sand. The cottonwood stood trembling as a desert wind blew warm across the land. Somewhere far away a coyote called out his lonesome ghostly song. And I knew that very soon sweet desert childhood would be gone. Can a man ever go back home again? Can a man ever live that way?